Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. June is Immigrant Heritage Month, and we are celebrating all month long by sharing past programs presented in conjunction with our special exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. This exhibit has been extended through 2021, and you can explore it in person at the American Writers Museum or online at my-america.org. We kick off this special series with Rebecca Dang, who shares her story as a South Sudanese refugee finding a home in the U.S. in her memoir, What They Meant for Evil. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Tonight is the second in our series of programs in conjunction with our newest exhibit, My America. We'd like to thank Gene and John Rowe for their sponsorship and support of this series and the exhibit. Tonight we're going to hear from Rebecca Dang, whose new book, What They Meant for Evil, is a recounting of her story as a lost girl of the Sudan and her journey from that country's civil war through a refugee resettlement program to the American Midwest. Since becoming to the U.S. in 2000, she's built a career as a speaker and advocate on behalf of women and children traumatized by war, including her current work with the American Bible Society's Mission Trauma Healing Program. She'll be interviewed tonight by our program director, Allison Sansoni, so please help me welcome Rebecca Dang.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight, Rebecca. This book is as much the story of your family as it is about your journey to America. Tell us a little bit about your childhood in Sudan, your village, and what your life was like there.
So I was born in Sudan. Sudan used to be Africa's largest country. I came from a southern part of the country that is a country now that is called South Sudan. So I was born into a Dinka tribe. South Sudan have about 65 tribes or more, I think. So I was born into a Dinka tribe, and I was born into a really what I would consider a beautiful family community. My dad was one of the SPLA general, South Sudan Liberation Movement. So he was in and out of the village, but I was raised by my mom, and my grandmother was around, and my village had what we call our grandmothers and uncle. It didn't matter if it is not your, you know, biological grandmother. We call them uncle and aunt. And my people are cattle herders, so we have a lot of cows. And we had 3 days a meal because really my family, when I read about statistic about Africa and people not eating, war bring that. But normal people without war, I was eating 3 meals a day. My family grow sorghum and maize and what we call corn and different kind of squash and vegetables. So my life was really... From ages 0 to 5, I will say that I had a pretty normal child raising, loving family. When I was 3, our village was attacked, and then my mom died. That's the first time I heard of the war. I heard that people were fighting, people from the North Sudan. And I asked one of my cousins one day, so where is Khartoum? And they say far away. And I thought that adults were crazy. Why are you going to fight somebody far away? But then that attack when my mom, we were running and she was in labor and there was no hospital and there was complications, so she didn't make it. That was the first time that war meant something to me. And then 4 years later or 3 years later, I went back to my normal life. Everything was normal. My aunts and uncle and my grandmother raised me. So I forget about the war. And then in 1991, when my village was attacked, that's what I remember, to be honest, and that's what I recorded, that's what I remember. And I was confused because when the enemies came and touched down our village and killed people, I was told that we're fighting the Arabs, right? But the people that show up kind of look like me, so I was confused. I'm like, what's going on? And then they're like, oh, these people that are together now with the North, and it didn't all make sense to me. But what happened from that journey, my uncle told me, hey, you know what? We are just going for a week. A week turned into a month, and a month turned into almost a year. And at that time, I was finding myself at the South Sudan border and Kenya, now South Sudan and Kenya. So that's pretty much how my life began. It was a normal childhood. And then I can talk more about the refugee camp.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, that this is what you remember. So how did you get in touch with these memories from when you were a very young child in order to write this book?
Yeah. I think when trauma happened to people and you don't understand what's going on, our normal instinct is to put it away and push it away and not think about it. Or people say, you know what, you are blessed in the United States and you have education. Now, why do you have to grip into thing of the past? But when something is imprinted in you, it's there. So for me, the memory of me writing came about one day when I was in Washington, D.C., and I was at the Native American Museum. And I came around a replica. It's a time bowl. I wish I have a bowl. But it have, like, beads on it and nuts. And then they say that a Native American woman, a young woman, was used the time bowl to record her courtship, marriage, and her other experience using the system of nuts and beads that only she could decipher. As she grew older, a woman might have several time bowls which she share her life story or keep those privately. But when she die, they are buried with her. And I read it like 5 times. And every time I come across when she die, they are buried with her. And at that point, I'm like, oh, my word. So if I die today, my story will be buried with me. I do have a lot of things that happened to me, from my mom died in my childhood and being a refugee to coming to United States and coming as a purse at an accompanied minor. Those are my thing that happened to me and my identities. So I promised myself that day that maybe one day I will consider writing. But then I put it away, right, like the rest of other thing. And then 2016, I had my son. And I was feeding my son, breastfeeding my son, and turning on the news. And there was news of immigrant children at the U.S. border. Children crying, children not knowing where their families were. And something just triggered in me as I looked down into my son that came into safety and security. All the memories of my childhood in my village of playing and having loving family, they all came pouring in. And then as I look into the TV and see the chaos and the suffering of children, all the memories of me being ripped apart from my village and leaving all came in. And at that time, I could not hold it in. And I thought to myself, I went back to the museum 4 years, and I'm like, oh, that thing that say your stories can be buried with you. And I say that if I choose to write my story, it might bring healing for me, and it might bring encouragement to the rest of humanity to just understand that when these people we consider as refugee or immigrant or children, they are normal people. They had a typical childhood and something happened, boom. And I really wanted people to understand the difference between immigrants and refugees, because when I talk to people, there's a lot of confusion. An immigrant is somebody that, because of what is happening in the environment, is too overwhelming and scary that they say life can no longer accommodate me. I have to make a journey. Even if it is a difficult journey that might end my life, I will make it and I will go out. A refugee is somebody that doesn't even have that pre-thought of I will make a journey. Most of refugee situation happen when you're sleeping and you're waking up and there's guns, there's bomb. There's people running, so you really literally running for your life. And I think when I was a kid, I was just running. I didn't even know what was going on. I didn't know what was refugee was about until I came to the border, and then I was told, now you are a refugee.
And when you got to the refugee camp, you thought, you know, initially that this would be a place that you were safe, but in some ways it turned out to be a dangerous place as well.
Yeah. So when I arrived in a refugee camp, first of all, it's Kakuma Refugee Camp. This is 1992. There were a lot of people pouring in. The refugee camp was not prepared, so there was no sewage system. We were given tents to live in. It was so dry. And I never been that hot in my life. South Sudan is hot, but like when I went there, it's so dusty, like dust storm, and going to sleep in a tent. And I just remember just dripping, and the whole land was so dry. And the only place you see wet thing is like people dripping and the sweat from them, or at the borehole where you pump water. And that was really hard because I came from a place called Duke. And that place is close to the Sut in South Sudan. So it's really green. So moving from a place where you see greenery and all the wildlife, you know, the wildebeest and the giraffe, to like a land that I didn't see butterfly, I didn't see, it was just so overwhelming. And the thing is, nobody was explaining to us what was going on. I remember asking my relative, what's going on? They say, oh, we're just here for now, and then we will go back to South Sudan to our country. And so it was month, and then it was 8 years later that I came to the U.S. And there are still my family members and friends that arrived in 1992 that are still there. They have tried to apply to get out of the refugee camp and to have a better life. And they can, because other countries close their borders and they don't want to welcome refugees. And when I talk to people and describe what it means to be a refugee or being in a refugee camp, for me, this is how I describe it. Somebody else might describe it differently, but I say that living in a refugee camp is like being in a life support machine. You are not living and you are not dying. You are giving basic thing to maintain you, but your hope and dream are killed. So you don't know. So if you have a generation, like people that arrived in 1992, the babies were born there, now they have their children. So you have a third generation. And what is the loss that we're doing to humanity? Those kids can be doctors, they can be engineers, they can be contributing because they hope and they dream. And when you meet somebody from a refugee camp, one of the things they say that I want to go to school, I want to be, they have those dreams, but there's no structure in a refugee camp to do that. And so people like us are responsible to do that. And for my book, I see my book as a way, a conversation starter where we can talk about those issues and really an opening floor for American, new American like me and all Americans that have been here and have seen things on one lens. And maybe bringing a new people that have a fresh eye is a good thing to be together and have a dialogue and why. And changing a demonizing voice around like these people are just coming to take advantage or these people are coming to do this. It's like actually these people come here because there's no choice for them. It's, they don't like taking advantage of somebody else is the last thing in their mind. They just want to get out and
they want to be safe.
Yeah, and be safe. Like what all humanity, all of us want security. All of us want to be loved and accepted, and that's what they want.
You came, you found a teacher in the refugee camp who helped you apply for the resettlement program. What was that process like when you coming to America?
Yes, so when I became a woman, when I got my first period, there was a man that asked my uncle hand in marriage. But in our culture, in a Dinka culture, a man have to pay dowry. You don't just get married. And in a refugee camp, all the refugees, men or whoever there's no jobs, right, for him. So he had to go back to South Sudan and collect dowry from his sisters or whatever, do business, I don't know. And at that time, so they say, go to Sudan, collect dowry, give this girl a year so that she can be a woman and be trained to be a woman, and you can come and marry her. He was like 30 years old. I'm like 15 or 14, going to 15. One of my teachers, and then at that time, actually, I was pulled out of school, and my uncle's wife teaching me how to cook all of these and making embroidery and me always really, oh, I was not successful. I will just do the needle and my hand will bleed. So my teachers, I went to do exam. One of the things that I asked my uncle, I have to show up for exam. And I went and took exam and I passed the class to go to the next class. And then my teacher took note of that. He's like, you haven't been showing up here, but you just came during exam week and you did really well. Have you heard that there's a program going on, the Lost Boys and Lost Girls of Sudan? I say, no. And he say, well, you can qualify because one of the qualifications is that you are an orphan, you don't have mom and dad, and that you would like to go to school. And I see you doing well in school, and you don't have mom and dad. And your uncle family is raising you, and plus two, you are being married off. It might not make sense to you, but you are really young. You should go. So I say, okay, I will apply. So he took me. I give him a fake name here for identity, for protection. So he took me to the UN, and I met there with somebody, a translator, and they asked me, and they interviewed me. The interview was long. They asked you a lot of questions. Sometimes it could be confusing or intimidating. And then I was sent back, and then I was about to come back, and they asked me for the Roshan. We are given a Roshan card, which doesn't have a name, but it has a number, which is connected to your file and all of that. I didn't know really how to read. And one of the things they find out was that they're like, this is not your card. And then I'm like, oh, my uncle, why? Because local people start attacking people at a time in a refugee camp. So my uncle, why, took my card, my Roshan card, sold it, and traveled to Sudan. And then she came back and bought somebody. I don't even know where they buy them. Give me
somebody. There was a mix-up with
it
the card.
It was a mix-up. And yeah. Then so she's like, oh, this is a huge problem. You might not go to United States. And I'm like, my heart just dropped because at that time, I will not have a choice. That man will come back a year later. I will be married up. And I could have been one of the statistics that you read about, a girl that died at childbirth or a girl that just become a mess. Some of them, like, you just end up being in poverty and some turn into drinking or into others, stuff that are not dignified in life. But my teachers they asked me to go back to school and bring all the transcript to approve that I was in Kakuma refugee camp in 92. And so they proceed ahead with Rebecca Reng. It's R-E-N-G. My last name is Deng. So it's a R and D mixed up, right? And how God do that, I don't know. So my name was like display. My uncle saw it, but he didn't know it was me. It was Rebecca Reng. It's not Rebecca Deng. And then 2 days before I left, we finally tell him, and he let me come. So, yeah, coming, that process of being a refugee or resettlement is really bad. It's a process. So when people say refugees are coming, we don't know where they're coming from. We don't know their background. No. UNHCR, no. U.S. Department of State, no. Homeland Security, no. They do a lot of background checkup, and they do multiple interviews to make sure that it is you, and they do all kind of testing, pregnancy tests, you know, HIV and other diseases, TB tests. So when we do come here, people know who we are. Yeah.
When you first came to America, you described, you know, really vividly in the book being the only, you know, feeling like you were the only non-white person mm-hmm. that you ever saw. But you found commonality with your foster family through faith.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about how that happened, how you discovered that they were people of faith as well, and how that brought you together.
Yeah. So when I realized that I'm coming to United States, I didn't know anything about the U.S. In a refugee camp, I never read book. There were some TV or videos that they showed that my cousin boys will go and they say, oh, we just saw you on Rambo or whatever, I don't know. But the girls were never allowed. I don't even know where they go with those things. So sometimes I'm like, can I go with you? Like, girls are not allowed to go see those things, and they learn Taekwondo or whatever. But I didn't know anything about the U.S. So when I learned that I'm coming to United States, and that I will be living with American family, and they are white family, I was like, okay. And then one of the things I had in my head, I just pray. I say, you know what? I never been to United States. I'm going to live with a different tribe because I'm from Dinka tribe of different people. I didn't know what the word race. You know, I heard that here in the United States. I just know people as people. So I'm like, I'm going to live with them. They don't know me. They don't know my background. I don't know their background. But if they have faith, if they believe in Jesus, that's one thing we will have in common. So I remember arriving at Grand Rapids Airport, walking into the light. I have never seen that brightness before. And then just looking out, and it's a sea of white people, blonde. And at that time, I was like, oh, my word, how can I even identify my family? Everybody looked the same. And then my my caseworker came in, and she's like, oh, I'm your caseworker, and these are your mom and dad. And I'm like, okay. We got in a car, and then with my broken English, right, I went to church because I'm like, I have to ask them if they are Christian. And they say church. And then I'm like, okay, I relax a little bit because I'm like, we have nothing in common. But if we know, if we have faith. And when I talk of faith, I'm not just talking about memorizing Bible and kind of, you know, using it as a way to bring others, people down. A faith is really that hope that thing can be broken, but they can be mend. A faith is an opening thing. A Bible, actually, like when I read it, it's an opening, it's an invitation for restoration, for identity, for you to be better. What people read and take out and twist it is another thing. So in my running and being in Kakuma refugee camp, faith like play a huge role. I was an orphan. It was women that have Bible study that invite me to beat a drum for them, and they will teach me of what it means to be a woman, what it means to be patient, what it means to be obedient, what it means to wait. Those things of faith were good. If they didn't teach me that, maybe I would have like do something and get pregnant and not come, but they told me wait, and those things were good things. They are principle that were not to condemn me, but more to like tell me, you are an orphan and you young, you do this thing. And for me, that's why faith play a huge role.
When I read your book, I was struck by the sense of longing that you had for a place that you could call your own. You know, you walked for days and months looking for a place that you could finally rest, that you could say was your home. Have you found that place here? And if not, where is the place where you feel most at home?
Mm-hmm. I would say that the United States, I feel at home. I feel at home because I arrived November 6th of 2000, so 19 years ago this November. This is the place that I have been for the longest time. So to me, it is home. United States is the first country I had a passport. So to me, it is home. So I consider U.S. as home, but I consider it as a home where I have to advocate and to talk about people, you know, opening the table and providing people like me, immigrant and refugees. So it is a home for me, but I know that to be a fully home for me, my boys have to be included so I feel belong. And I have to include others, people, voices, and open up for the ideas, for the suggestion. And so U.S. is home. I went back to South Sudan in 2015 with my job for a trauma healing program. I did a trauma healing training with children and then did some with some of the church members. And my hope was that we can do more trauma healing training with the military because there's a huge military, you know, culture. It was a country that just come out of war, and to just really let people understand what trauma does to people. Like if you are aggressive, if you are these, all those are symptoms of trauma. And when I look into South Sudan culture, like right now, they report a lot of things, human abuse, women raping women, killing children. These are not South Sudanese traditional culture. These are symptoms of trauma and war. And sometimes it makes me really sad because when I left my village, I never saw anybody beating any woman. Like, all of those abusive things that you see, oh, these are African cultures, or they are South Sudan, they were never there. Anybody, I talk in my book here of my dad coming back from the battlefield, and I will always want to run and hug him, and my grandmother holding me back until they kill a cow, and my dad will jump over the cow and then greet the women and children. And my grandmother used to say that when soldiers are in the battlefield, they enter a different world. We don't know. They are not clean. They have to be clean. They have to be atonement before they greet the women and children. So there was a respect for life. And when I see in an article or like thing that I reported and then is seen as a culture, that's not culture. That's a symptom of war and trauma, and we need to address that, and we need to find our roots of who we were before the war. Because you cannot really understand if you just focus on in the middle of thing and don't know the root cause, we will never move forward. But if we look back and say, who were we before the war, and where are we now? And so what went wrong? And that's what... So South Sudan is my second home, or Africa in general, and I would like to continue to go back and be engaged in these important conversations.
You talked a lot about, in your book, about the language barrier, especially when you were trying to continue your education here in the States and learning English. Are there still things that you feel are best expressed in another language? Or when you were writing this book, did you think, if I could just write it in, you know?
Yes, many times. I get so frustrated many times. There are just things in your heart language, even like the way I laugh, right? I can talk and joke in English and laugh, but like when I'm among my Dinka people and say something, I will just have that uncontrollable laugh that some people will think I'm crazy. But there are some things, yeah, I think heart language is so important for people. And there are things that even if I can write better and I can speak English, but there is a deficiency that will always be there, that I will never express things in English in a way I can express them in my mother tongue, my Dinka. I don't know how to read or write Dinka, but I know how to speak it. And when I think in Dinka and want to translate it into English, it's so confusing because some things are so complex, and because I never understand the writing system of Dinka, maybe that's why I struggle to translate it. I don't know. But I just know that if you have your first language, what I consider a hard language, that language is always going to play a role. And sometimes I'm just like, I wish there's a way I can just speak in Dinka and that will translate it straight into English, and then it will be easy. But that's a struggle that I will always have. No matter how much I study English, I think it's just gonna be difficult. Just like my kid, they were born here, English is their second language. Even if they learn Dinka, I'm sure they will always struggle.
Yeah. I like the phrase heart language. Mm-hmm. That's when,
yeah,
you,
it's a
when
language
you go
that
back
just sing
to that.
In. Yeah. You don't have to have a lot of explanation. Like in Dinka language, if somebody say yakidi, it's like, what is this? You know, oh, that word by itself can mean multiple things, and you will say them like, oh, okay. They don't even need to elaborate. But what I feel in English, I have to elaborate for every point to even get to the point, right? So that's hard.
What do you hope when your children read this book? What do you hope that they come to know about you from it?
Yeah. So when my children, so I really, this book exposed a lot of my past trauma, and it was a conscious decision where you just put yourself out there. And our natural human response is to conceal something that kind of seems shameful or kind of like broken. But I really want my children to know that we as human beings are complex animals or people. Bad things can happen as well as good things can happen at the same time, and to recognize those and to let the healing take on naturally. And I want my kid to neighbor, because they are born into safety and everything. I want them to always know others, people that they might read in a newspaper or has a number, has a statistic, to have a respect for them, because those people, they are just like them. It's just, they just happen to be in that country or in that situation that they are suffering. And I also want my children to know that no matter what life bring in their life, if there's a brokenness or something, that's part of human being, and that is not the only identity. So exposing my trauma and explaining it and putting out there, it was to encourage them, hopefully, to be courageous one day if something happened in their life and be like, my mom have been there and she did it, or people like that have done it before, I can do it. Or even not for them, that they can encourage their friends that are in that situation.
Is there a part of the book that you'd like to read for us tonight?
Yeah, let me. I can read from, I can read a little bit of my village, the description of my village. So this is back in South Sudan, Jonglei State right now, in a area of Dukpadiet. The village was called Arwai Mayen, but it doesn't exist anymore. I actually never been to Dukpadiet. I don't know where it is. I grew up in Arwai, and then I left when I was 5, going to 6, and I grew up in a refugee camp in Kenya and came to the U.S., in 2015, when I went back there, I wanted to go to Dukpadiet, but there was a lot of insecurity going on, and I couldn't go. So I hope to make a trip there and see that place. But I'm going to read now, describing my grandmother garden. So I love Kokor garden. It had so many colors and variety of food, green vegetables, red tomato, sorghum, okra, pumpkin, colorful maize, squash. I love watching Kokor walk in her garden because she would rustle up hundreds of butterflies and dragonflies that flutter through the crop, kissing leaves. And the birds in the garden, they were colorful too, red, yellow, black heads, blue, turquoise, golden, yellow, all beautiful. Kokor would often talk about birds and shout to them so they can run away and not eat our crops. I love harvest time when the women would grind fresh corn, sorghum, and others' grain. The air around give off slightly sweet smell. Sometime we, the children, were especially called to come if we are disciplined and good. The women would peel the sorghum stem and give it to us to eat. The sweet smell would fill my nose. I would bite off the husk, and then I would take off the leaf and open the stem. Sometimes the inside was vivid red. We called this Dab's wine. It was like a candy. I loved looking at all the colors of our village. I saw aloe, which was a kind of grass, which is tall, golden grass. It was like thousands of yellow cats turned upside down. The fuzzy top of the grass always make me feel good. And everywhere I look, our huts, I saw the greenest green I ever saw. Kokok said our land was the greenest place in the whole world. Large pastures, she called it, made that way because the Nile River set and her tribute were so close to our village. We were only 20 minutes walk to the stream, and only a day walk to the Nile. So that is a description of my village. It was that beautiful. Do you want me to read another passage when I came to the border?
Did you want to read the part about the Statue of Liberty when you came here?
Yeah, I can read that. So I will describe here when I was going from Nairobi to Europe to here. So for the next 24 hours, I went from flight to flight, from Nairobi to Amsterdam, to New York City, to Grand Rapids. And each airport, someone meet me and help me get to the next flight. In Amsterdam, the group split, which add another level of trauma. So we came as lost boys and lost girls together, but we have to split to go to different cities. Because we thought we were going to one place, but then we ended up going to different direction. As we were landing in New York, I looked outside my window and recognized the Statue of Liberty because it was on the cover of our cultural orientation book. She looked so beautiful, standing in the middle of water, holding a lamb and a book. I thought about the lamb she held, the guiding star for new hope and life. My mind went back to Kakuma refugee camp, my home. How crazy and scary it was to leave that place to come to the unknown world. I was glad the person holding the lamb was a lady. My whole life, women had taken care of me, and something deep down told me to trust that my life here would be okay. By the time we arrive in Grand Rapids, or Grand Rubbish, which I thought it was called, there was only six of us left. My distant cousin on my side of family, two boys and girl, another boy and me. The IOM representative told her that Bethany Christian Services was sponsoring us. So we believed Bethany Christian Services was one family, and we were all going to be together. But as we flew to Grand Rapids, they told her that we were going to different towns in Michigan, and I was going to Harlan. Wait, I said, we are not going to Bethany Christian Services? A woman shook her head. Bethany Christian Services is a resettlement agency that you are going through. You have your own family to go with. So really we are being separated, I thought. Tears sprung to my eyes. I wonder if I would ever see my cousin again. We landed in the evening. As I walk off the plane into the waiting area, I blink at the bright lights at the airport, but also the sea of white people we are talking about at the refugee camp. We saw one or two in a while, and on a trip from Kakuma, we saw some white, but blended in with other races. So TV crew was there, people with cameras. Oh, God, I don't care what color my family is. Just please let them know Jesus. I pray silently. At least if they know Jesus, we have something in common. I was assigned a social worker who led me to my new family. Three people, all pasty white and very young looking, stood smiling and waiting to greet me. They had kind eyes. The man introduced himself as Lennis Baggage. That's my foster dad. But I could not quite get his name, Lennis. It was hard for me to understand. Another lady was Heather, and their daughter was Rachel, but she had a British accent. And I recognized Rachel's name because it's a biblical name, and I had a friend in a refugee camp that is called Rachel. My foster dad hugged me and say, Habari yako, which is like, how are you in Swahili? And I say, wewe ni dinka mzuri, you are a good dinka. It was a good gesture for him to greet me that way. But later on, I learned that actually the young girl that I thought is my sister, Rachel, is my foster mom, and Heather, that I thought is my mom, is dear friend that came to support them to receive me. And so when my foster mom and my foster dad got me, my foster mom was only 29, so she was young. They were pregnant with their first baby, and so I was their first one. And then a month later, another South Sudanese refugee girl joined me, and so we were in a family together, which you will read in the book here. But yeah, that was my time of arriving in the United States. And then, of course, going to a high school, being there. I would say that I was kind of like the first ESL student, and they didn't know where my English was, so my ESL teachers read me magazine for the first month. And then I have a friend back there, Karen Gensing, that befriended me. And that's what I told a student this morning, that your job might be for you, if you are at school, to look out for somebody that look out a place. Invite them to have lunch with you. Invite them for your getting together with your friend. Because that's how I learn English, just listening to my friend talking, and then, of course, ESL teachers. So we all have a job to do. And we, too, that are newcomers, and I have been here now for 19 years. If there's a new person that come, I have a responsibility to tell them so that they don't repeat the mistake that I have done when I came, or just show them where they will need help. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here with us tonight.
Thank you,
Rebecca, for telling your story.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next week as we continue our Immigrant Heritage Month celebrations with acclaimed poet and MacArthur Fellow, Halid Matawa, whose recent collection, Fugitive Atlas, is a sweeping, impassioned collection of poems that touches on themes of immigration, occupation, environmental destruction, and more. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.